Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit, from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Twitter and Instagram at thecellosherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Tony Mazzocchi is a trombonist, the director of Montclair State University's Cali School of Music, and co-director, along with his wife, Deborah Buck, of the Kinhaven Music School located in Vermont. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
It's great to be here, Joel. Thank you.
So the Kinhaven Music School, located in Weston, Vermont, is a residential summer music camp. With programs and workshops for both youth and adults, Kinhaven specializes in classical chamber music, orchestra, and piano education in a nurturing, non-competitive, and collaborative environment. Kinhaven's culture reflects its strong belief in the benefits of shared learning, mutual support, friendship, community, and diversity. How do you go about creating an environment that lives up to this unique and bold mission?
Yeah, well, when I hear that question, it's actually pretty heavy. You know, this is our 71st year. Kinhaven was founded in 1952. And what I found very interesting about the three sets of directors, basically, that have been there, my wife and I are the third set, is that Kinhaven certainly has changed over the years, actually while maintaining our core values. And it's something I'm most proud of. And really, the idea behind Kinhaven, as it was envisioned by the founders, David Dushkin, was, you know, he believed strongly that children who have a common passion, obviously in this case music, when they're removed from their environment that has all of these distractions and compromises and conflicts that are most likely undermining their gifts, and they are placed with each other with that shared passion in nature for many weeks, can live with music and transform through that. And that concept is not only beautiful, but in the year 2022, when we look at all of the compromises and conflicts and distractions that exist, I mean, compared to 1952, right?
Yeah.
These young human beings, and quite frankly, the adults too, need this probably, arguably, more than ever before.
Yeah.
And so, as director of the institution, it's really my job to, it doesn't happen accidentally, actually. It's very intentional. I mean, we don't sit everybody down when they get there and say, this is what's going to happen. But, you know, right now, the intentionality of it includes we ask everybody to give us their phones. We go tech free. And we create an environment where the students start engaging with each other face to face for the first time, and the adults as well. And everything we do together. And we create this community. So inherent in that is kind of what you mentioned. It is non-competitive, meaning that, of course, we have far more students who apply to Kinhaven that we can accept. So, but that's where the competition ends. We create a community where, you know, the sum of all parts is greater than the individual. And that's very different than how I was trained as a musician, maybe how you were trained as a musician.
Absolutely.
Maybe me a little less so as a trombonist. We liked playing with each other. But anyway, you know, so really, you know, that's the core of it. And that's where, that's my true north. And it suits these young people very well. And I believe we need more places like it.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure I answered your question, but that's kind of where I went with that.
Well, let's talk about a few of these things. So number one, taking away people's electronics. I mean, that's pretty huge in this day and age. Logistically, do you take them at the beginning of the 6 weeks and give them back at the end of 6 weeks? Or is there time during the camp that they're allowed to use their electronics?
Last year was the first year. You know, we've had to kind of go slowly with this because of the advancement of technology. What we did for a while when the smartphone started becoming, you know, really prevalent, was take their SIM cards so that they could use it to take photos. Uh-huh. You know, they said that you're using it as a metronome and a tuner, but I didn't hear a lot of clicks going on in the And so last year during COVID, I said, you know what, this is the perfect time for us to pilot just taking the phone. Mm-hmm. And after a year where everybody was online every minute of the day, I was pleasantly surprised to see the students say, please take it. Hmm. You know, just take it. Now, the first few days were, there was withdrawal. I mean, I'm sure. it was something to watch, adults and kids.
Yeah.
And I foresee that happening again this summer, but that is what we're doing. And I will tell you, I thought it was going to be more of a battle than it actually was. Mm-hmm. Some of the parents were a little more concerned, but we have a landline. Everybody can call, and the parents start learning really quickly that the kids don't call home.
Yeah.
Because they're having a great time. So no, that's what we do now. We take the entire phone and we have old school metronomes if you want to use them. They still don't get checked out very often. And it's a total detox. There's no other term to use. It's a detox.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I mean, we're so connected to our electronics, and especially all of the students of this generation, to have to take the phone away and have real conversations probably is a stretch and a challenge for some people because they're so connected now in this way. I mean, I think back, I went to Interlochen for high school, and I've often thought, how did we find each other? Because we didn't have phones, we couldn't communicate with each other, but we still managed to meet up and do the same things. It's just, we didn't know what we were missing. And now to go back to that would seem to be challenging, but also refreshing at the same time, I would imagine.
Well, you know, if I take a quick walk through campus with a phone to video what's going on a typical day, you'd see me walk through the main house and there'd be some students playing some board games, a game of chess, somebody would be reading a book on the couch. I'd walk outside and we have this huge hill, we call it the Sitting Hill, that just overlooks the mountains. And there are students in groups of 3, 4, 6 sitting in a circle, just chatting with each other. Some other kids would be shooting some basketball. You'd hear some practicing in the background. So that's what it's like. It's actually true, deep engagement.
Yeah.
It's really amazing to watch. And it gives me a lot of hope, actually.
Yeah. So what do you look for in a potential student when they audition for Kinhaven?
Yeah, that's an interesting question because, you know, really it's changed over the past couple of years because we had in-person auditions as well as the ability for students to send in videos. And of course, over the last couple of years, we've been doing it completely via video. So I loved meeting every potential student and chatting with them. It wasn't an interview. I just liked to chat with them. Mm-hmm. So obviously, they need to be playing and performing at a certain level. Kinhaven has grown in the musical rigor that we have students engaged in. So they need to be playing at a certain level, obviously, to get in. But from there, what I love about Kinhaven is there's no cookie cutter student. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, funny, and you know, I went to Interlochen. I went to Interlochen for the summer session. Mm-hmm. And Interlochen, when I went there, was like the antithesis of Kinhaven. Yeah. And it was perfect for me because I was a very, very competitive kid. Uh-huh. If I went to Kinhaven, I'm not sure if I would have known how to operate very well there, which is very interesting. So really, every student who comes to Kinhaven very much is like us in their outliers in their regular places where they're at school, right? Just because of their interests. I mean, how many students in one school do you find highly interested in classical music and all that stuff? So, yeah. And they come here, it's a real melting pot, all different backgrounds, all different type of kid, but they all share that passion with one another and they learn to deal with their differences because, you know, the diversity is there. We have students from all over the socioeconomic spectrum. I have a very deep passion for, you know, equalizing the environment as far as diversity in the field and bringing students from underrepresented backgrounds in the field, underserved communities. Mm-hmm. That's a deep mission. We have students who are, you know, transitioning. I've had a student who was a girl one summer, a boy the next summer. and had the same circle of friends. You know, it's just such a nurturing community from top to bottom. So there's no cookie cutter student. I just watch them and I know that when they get done with Kinhaven, they're going to be a different kid.
Yeah.
That's the fun part.
Well, what would you say then about the percentage of the student population that is considering pursuing a path in music professionally?
You know, it varies every year. I would say the majority of the students think they may want to go into music. When they're done with the summer, there are more than there were when the summer started. But there are also students who are deeply involved in their other aspects of their lives, and music just plays a crucial part. And they go on to do all sorts of things, you know, writers, artists, doctors, lawyers, everything in between. But that time that they had at Kinhaven is such a pivotal moment for them. And that's why Kinhaven can be a training ground for young musicians if that's what they want. But it really is a place of balance where there is deep immersion in music and then there's deep immersion in just other humans in nature.
Yeah.
And usually that's kind of split from the first half of the day to the second half of the day. Now, in the second half of the day, students who want to practice another 4 hours can, and sometimes they do. But I think that that time where they're just getting to really experience themselves surface, because they're so busy during the year, right? Some of their schedules are so hyper-regulated by others. And they come here, and there's a lot of freedom at Kinhaven, actually. There's a lot of freedom. Sometimes it's more than they're used to or even can handle for a while, and we deal with that.
Yeah.
But, you know, they have a chance over time to really find themselves. And that process is a pretty incredible thing, actually, for me to watch. And you never know what's going to happen with it as far as what that does on their path. And I think they, you know, our alum who speak about it speak far more eloquently than I ever could, because it really happened to them, you know.
Yeah. So you have a selection process for chamber music that I think is also pretty unique. Can you talk about how that works?
Yeah, I'm assuming maybe you saw the video, because I had to memorialize this.
Yeah.
I had to have a little documentary made of it, which you can find on YouTube, because it is so fascinating. And basically, we get to learn about every single student at camp, and we meet as a faculty every week to talk about them. And when we talk about them, as well as our counselors talk about them, we talk about every ounce of what they're doing, you know, what friends they're making, how are they eating, how are they sleeping, who are they, what are they interested in, how are they playing. You know, we have a baseline. We call it an audition at the beginning of camp, but, you know, it's really, now we just want everybody to hear them play. And the faculty get together and over the course of many, many hours deliberate and find repertoire that's form fit for each student, and find other students who are form fit for that group as well, that will take them from point A to point B that week. And then there's a performance at the end of the week. They sight read it on Monday and they're performing it on Friday.
You know? Wow.
And then it continues and another group is made the next week. So that's the Reader's Digest version of the process, but it's very student-centric. And you know, when you sit back and you watch your faculty talking about each student, you realize that what we've created there is an environment where the faculty and the students really, truly get to know each other. It's not like, you know, when we were kids, you get to see your teacher once a week for that hour less, and you're like, see you later. We're eating with them family style around the table. And, you know, kids are asking me about what I do for a living or what kind of music I like. And it's that fine line between, you know, teacher and mentor and future colleague,
right?
And it is future colleague because we have former Kinhaven students who work at Kinhaven and teach with us at Kinhaven, right? So anyway, the process is really fascinating and very mindful.
Yeah. Sounds like a great place. Makes me want to go back to being a student and go back to camp.
Yeah. I get to kind of relive that every year a little bit while I'm stressing out about, you know, the water turning off or something like that, which happens in Vermont a lot.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about your role at the Cali School of Music. Can you talk about what a day in your life looks like, what your responsibilities are as a director of the school? Because I know you came from a position of being a performer, a trombonist and a teacher and performer, which I assume you still do. But then shifting into that role as director had to be a bit of a life change. So I'd love to hear, especially for those who might be considering taking that type of a career path, what that job is like and what it entails.
Okay. Yeah, well, every day is quite different. So, you know, yeah, I'm the director of the John J. Kelly School of Music at Montclair State University, a very, very special place. Director and dean sometimes is interchangeable, but that's basically what I am, right? Mm-hmm. And so as director, technically speaking, I am the educational and artistic leader of the institution. That doesn't mean I'm the best artist and I'm the best educator, but that means that I have to help design and implement the vision based on all of the incredible talent around me, from my colleagues who are the professors and performers, and carve a way forward for the school during a time now, right, post-COVID, that I would argue is probably the most important time in the history of schools of music and the performing arts in this nation, because of the devastation laid by COVID, not only on the performing arts community, which has, you know, been changed dramatically and thinned out in some places, but specifically the K-12 environment that's been really devastated by COVID. All these students who normally may start a musical instrument or singing in their lives in the fourth, fifth, sixth grade around the nation didn't have that opportunity. Many schools didn't meet in person. And then, as we know, starting students from scratch online didn't really quite work out.
Right.
We have a huge problem that has occurred and has rippling effects for years if we don't address it. That's probably for another podcast altogether. Mm-hmm. But for the School of Music, my job, I have to have my foot inside the school with what's going on with curricula, teaching and learning, the day-to-day operations. I have to have my foot outside of the school, which is community engagement and what I was talking about, what's going on in the K-12 and professional environment, so that we can make what we're teaching inside the school relevant mm-hmm. and meaningful for our students, and preparing the future performers, educators, and music therapists to do their best work. I have to look for opportunities to showcase what we're doing and raise funds and galvanize audiences and donors, so that we can, you know, raise funds for what we need, especially scholarship, and do things to put our name on the map, so that we can be involved with outreach and awareness that we actually even exist. I mean, a lot mm-hmm. of people haven't even heard of Montclair State, right? But we're right outside the city. We have the same faculty as Juilliard School, Manhattan School of Music, and we have some really incredible offerings. So there's more, right? So I wouldn't be able to do what I do well if it was not for my musical training and my professional experience as a trombonist and an educator. But it's only in the last 2 years where I've actually stepped away from performing for the most part mm-hmm. for the first time in my life, which was difficult. I guess for anybody who really wants to go into administration, I would really say that unless you're really ready, and I'm not saying I was, but I became ready. Unless you're really ready to step back and watch other people succeed and do their best work and be legitimately happy for them and want to create an environment where they can do their best work, not you do your best work, but you get something out of that,
yeah,
then you might not be ready for administration if you're not ready to do that.
Interesting.
Because, you know, you may find yourself, I mean, I think we've all know people like this. They're a little bitter. You know, they kind of want to jump in there and be doing it themselves. And that means they're not ready.
Yeah.
And there creates some, we'll call it dissonance.
I like that word. It works well. So how many years would you say that you led your life with performance being the first thing that you focused on versus now taking a backseat to administration?
Well, I guess, you know, when you look at it from the age of 8 until I would say 40.
Uh-huh.
It happened slowly. You know, when I started teaching and educating and started thinking about other people besides myself, I slowly fell in love with that. And then I wanted to teach teachers how to do what I did because I happened to be okay at it.
Yeah.
And that was another step. And after I taught teachers, I kind of wanted to scale it, right? And the more I wanted to scale it, the more up the ladder of administration I got. And leading Kinhaven has been just a total honor. But that's a place where, you know, you really, it's a nonprofit. There's not a lot of bureaucracy. You want to make changes. Let's make changes and let's bring people along and develop the place and see what the impact is on the students. That's the beauty of being an educational administrator. Your true north is always what's best for students. Mm-hmm. And then secondary, what's best for the adults. And if you can get both of those right, then you're doing really well.
Yeah.
But when you know that the effect on the students is profound, then you know you're headed in the right direction. So, and I think that is different with educational administration. You do have that feedback loop, right?
Yeah.
And so, you know, I enjoyed it. I enjoy it more and more as time goes on. It is very difficult work. And leading through COVID has been one of the greatest challenges of my life. I wouldn't trade it for anything because I've come out of it older, wiser, well, older. But what, you know, wiser and more knowledgeable. And I can't imagine anything will be this hard in life. And I'm glad it was me because I really cared a lot. You know, I love the institutions where I work and I love the people and I love the students and I wanted to see everybody healthy, but I believed in my soul that we should all be in person, and we were.
Yeah.
And I was happy to figure out a way to operationalize those dreams, right? Because as an administrator, you can have dreams. Everybody's got some decent ideas.
Yep.
But you have to be able to operationalize those and rely on the human capital around you to do that and to follow you. And that's where the rubber hits the road. You know, that's the real magic of it.
Yeah. And I think that not only have we been through a global pandemic that is still going on, but this time period, we've also seen the industry go through a tremendous amount of reflection about the lack of diversity in our field. Mm. So I'd love to know how you're approaching that at the Cali School of Music, just as you had to approach a pandemic at the same time, this coming on its heels and all of the conversation that's happening around how we bring more diversity to our field, what kinds of things you're working on to make that happen also.
Yeah. Well, thanks for bringing that up. Obviously, you know, for many reasons, right, that was at the forefront during this pandemic. And, you know, finally, people were shaken into having to pay attention to what's been under our nose for a very long time, which is systemic issues in the music field mm-hmm. of access and equity.
Yeah.
At the youngest ages, especially for classical music. Now, my strange and twisty and turning path towards doing what I was doing involved a lot of time in the public school system in New York City mm-hmm. and New Jersey. I never thought my life would bring me there, but it did. And it was some of the most rewarding work I ever did. And I became so fascinated by a lot of things, but which included how public education potentially is magical and transformative. And when we talk about music programs, the potential for greatness to sprout out of public school is through the roof. And there are public school music programs around this country that are phenomenal.
Yeah.
And there are also places where there's nothing. I became so fascinated with why, you know, music was so low on the totem pole as far as this like meritocracy of subjects that we hold dear in America, where you've got English and language arts and math at the top and music, dance, and drama at the bottom.
Yeah.
And I was so fascinated by trying to figure out, you know, why not only this was in the system, but why the general public has accepted it so freely and believes that, you know, music and the arts is really only for a chosen few, right? It's like you're talented or you're not.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, to make a long story short, I got so into it that I decided to run for public office and run for Board of Education seat here in New Jersey because I wanted to know, you know, how deep this ran legislatively as far as budgets are concerned and the minds of administrators and lawmakers. And so I got on the Board of Ed and I learned a lot about this. So, you know, in essence, I think what we do in the public school system, specifically in the education system, as far as the arts are concerned, is we create the haves and have-nots at the very earliest of ages. And then we pretend that that's because students were either born talented or they weren't. Mm-hmm. And so not only does that divide into haves or have-nots, but it disproportionately affects students from low socioeconomic backgrounds and students of color. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we do that at the youngest ages, and now we have a lot of higher education leaders saying, wow, you know, geez, we need to accept more students of color into the, yeah, well, it's not that easy.
Yeah.
There are systemic issues. Let's take a look at what these are all about. And so I've been passionate about this for a very long time. I can't say that I've done as much as I'd like, but one of the programs that I developed during COVID was called the Cali Pathways Project. And I modeled this after a few other pathways initiatives that exist in the United States, but as it turns out, as we sit here today, we're the only university that has a pathways project like this, to my knowledge. Mm-hmm. And you were talking about the Atlantic Music Project when we were in Atlanta Symphony, right?
Yep.
My friend Stanford Thompson, who came out of that, who's also in Philadelphia, and I were talking the other day, and he assured me that I think out of the 13 or 14 pathways projects, as much as he knows, we're the only university one. And what I did here is I urged my professors to take themselves out of their, you know, the brick and mortar of the university walls and follow me into the K through 12 system and through a nomination process and a real intentional search for students who may be otherwise invisible. We identified high schoolers throughout the region who were from underserved communities and underrepresented backgrounds in the field, who showed talent, but who had massive barriers in front of them towards realizing their goals. And those barriers, as we learned, were very different. Our professors ended up being case managers for these students. One particularly, her name is Tomoko Fujita, who is our coordinator for the Pathways Project, did amazing work as a case manager, learning about each student's story, figuring out where their little net of influence is. And it could be a guidance counselor, it could be one music teacher. And what our job was to do was to expand that web of influence. And like I said, these barriers, maybe they didn't have a good instrument to play on. We purchase an instrument for them. Maybe they didn't have money to get from their house to the youth orchestra we wanted them to play with, you know, and so on and so forth, quite frankly. I mean, we started unpeeling this onion and we found that I had to get the admissions officers from the university to talk to the parents about how to fill out a FAFSA form and how to apply for college or what college was or what they were supposed to be doing if they were here and why it's important. Mm-hmm. And so we followed each student who had a different story, who had different needs. We're helping break down these barriers. And we made sure that the goal was for them to audition for and be accepted to the Cali School of Music or anywhere for that matter. But if they were accepted to the Cali School, they would come on a full tuition scholarship.
Yeah, that's pretty great.
Yeah. And we had 32 students in the program. We have 11 students coming to the Cali School of Music next year on a full scholarship. We had some very generous donors who have funded this because it costs money. We need to make that kind of investment. And the fact of the matter is that I think this is the way that we need to move forward with this work. I hope other universities and schools of music join me. Now, what I hope happens, because of course, you know, we can put a little dent in things. I can't solve the world's problems this way. But if we then go back to the schools where these students were invisible and we show them that with the right supports, that they can find themselves and achieve great things, and also tell them that they're not so special that their kid right next to them can't be doing the same thing too, mm-hmm. that maybe we can change enough mindsets so that there aren't these haves and have-nots, because the arts is for everybody.
Yeah.
And I believe talent is nurtured and cultivated, not inborn and inherent for the most part. And once we change those mindsets, maybe something can happen. But, you know, that's my blue sky. I hope we can start crawling towards that. But the Cali Pathways Project is something I'm very proud of.
Yeah, that's great. And how many years has that been going on then?
This is the first year. We just finished our first year.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think when I look at the talent development program, it's a very similar type of idea. I think the thing that we would all love to see is larger programs, so more students having access, but then getting to those students earlier too, I think would also make a difference. I feel like a lot of what's happening right now is a knee-jerk reaction to try and fix something at the end of the line. Like, we need to hire more people of color. We need to bring more people of color into music schools. But then if you don't have something that starts much earlier to get people ready to take that path, you're not going to have the kinds of numbers that people are hoping for.
Yeah, well, you're right. This is not a magic wand moment, and there is no magic wand for this. But with COVID really laying bare the issues, we need to go at this with all of our might, because our problems are big. We have a generation of human who has not had appropriate arts education at this time. We're all going to be feeling that in a few years if we don't pay attention.
Yeah, and then what happens is you look at the ripple effect. If you don't have arts educations in schools, then those are our future administrators, legislators, people that are in positions of power to make change that don't see the value in it because they never experienced it themselves. So it's
sort of
a self-fulfilling problem.
It is a problem.
Well, this has been a really great conversation. I'm sure we could talk a lot more. I'd love to know, though, where people can find you online and more information on some of these programs we discussed. And I will definitely put all of this in the show notes.
Oh, I appreciate it. Well, boy, where can they find me? It's a little hard to find me, but I think kinhaven.org or montclair.edu/music, you'll see me up on there. But those are two really fantastic institutions that I would love people to check out. You'll see that the work that we're doing there is really special. I really appreciate you having me on this podcast. It's always great to talk about it, Joel.
Well, thank you. And thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Thank you.
I want to give a big thank you to Tony Mazzocchi for talking with us today, and thank you for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. For more information on Tony and for the links we discussed, make sure you check out the show notes by scrolling down on the episode. Be sure and catch our next episode where we interview Matt Chaimovitz, who's a cellist that made his debut at the age of 13 as soloist with Zubin Mehta and the Israel Philharmonic. He is currently Associate Professor of Cello at McGill University's Schulich School of Music in Montreal. We talk about what it was like to start his professional career at such a young age and what he has been up to lately. We're here to serve you, so if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecellosherpa.com, or tweet them at us, @thecellosherpa. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was produced, edited, and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.